Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along as we talk about natural resources and conservation in Wisconsin today, some of the challenges ahead, but also a lot of the success stories. We've had many great success stories, and we'll visit about them today with our two guests from the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Drew Feldkirchner is the director of the program. And Drew, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
And Rich Dafin, conservation biologist. And Rich, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, good to be here.
Great to have you both here. You may have some questions about endangered resources or some of the conservation efforts here in Wisconsin. These guys can talk a lot about that. And I hope you'll give us a call. Number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you and hope you'll participate. And, well, Drew, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the Natural Heritage Conservation Program to begin with.
Okay, great. Yeah, we are a program within the DNR, so we're one of the bureaus in the DNR. We have a long history, not as long as some of the other programs. The program really grew out of kind of some of the things that were going on in the 1960s related to endangered species and some of the federal legislation that came out of that. Going into the 70s, we had the Endangered Species Act, and listeners might be interested to know that Wisconsin actually had the first state Endangered Species Act. And so that was a big kind of part of laying the groundwork. And our program's changed over the years. You know, we're very, very small when we started out. We're still relatively small, but we've certainly grown, and we're working on a lot of interesting things, a lot of different areas. Kind of one big thing that happened to us in the 1980s was the Natural Heritage Inventory was established by state statute, and that directed us to track all the rare species and high-quality areas in the state. So we keep track of that, and we're part of a what became a national is now an international network of programs that do that work. And so that's still an important part of what we do. And like you mentioned, we've had a lot of successes over the years, still a lot of challenges ahead. And it's a really exciting time, though, I think, in conservation in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I think the goals, I mean, I guess the overall goals have changed, may have stayed the same. Mm-hmm. But the emphasis, of course, changes over time as conditions warrant.
Yeah, definitely. We did some, actually in 2013, we did some kind of changes within our program in terms of being able to have more staff out in different parts of the state so we could reach more parts of the state. So that was really great. We actually changed our name at that time. We used to be called the Endangered Resources Program, and that's still, endangered species is still a very important part of what we
sure.
do. But we changed our name to more accurately reflect kind of
the broader range
of what we do.
Now, Rich, tell us about your role within the program.
Yeah, so I'm a zoologist and conservation biologist, and as Drew mentioned, I work with the Natural Heritage Inventory portion of the program. So I do coordinate some inventory and monitoring throughout the state. A lot of the inventory takes place on state lands, so it's kind of the precursor to what we refer to as master planning.
Yeah,
it's basically setting the management goals and strategies for a property. And the first thing that we do is do a biotic inventory, so we kind of coordinate those efforts. I head up some of the zoology portion of that, so mm-hmm. a lot of the vertebrate inventory portions, like bird surveys, breeding bird surveys, forest raptor surveys, amphibians and reptile work, and then also some mammals. We do a lot of work with terrestrial invertebrates like butterflies and moths and other aquatic invertebrates, dragonflies. So we really kind of run the gamut of different taxa. We do rare plant surveys as well for those type of inventories. And then that all goes into our natural heritage inventory database, which Drew mentioned.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about the Karner blue butterfly. One of my graduate students, now this is years ago, for her master's thesis, took a look at the planning and how that planning went to kind of preserve the Karner blue butterfly. And I was impressed with the broad range of people you brought in to you know, to sort of look at that problem from all different perspectives, business and environmentalists and the whole ball of wax. It was really pretty interesting, and I guess that's something probably you guys have had to do anyway, as to, you know, you got a smaller staff than you may like, but at least you can bring in a lot of outside people who are more, you know, willing to help.
Yeah, absolutely.
True. Yeah.
We rely on partners throughout the state. I mean, that's a huge part. Maybe we'll talk about more later, not only partners and other organizations and nonprofits, but also citizens, whether they're citizen scientists or volunteers. We have kind of a network that we work with. And the Carnar Blue Butterfly, that was really interesting. That's what's called a habitat conservation plan. So that's because they're federally listed. I don't know if people probably realize we have some federally endangered and threatened animals in the state, and that's one of them.
Yeah, very cool. Let's give Dennis a chance to join in from Beaver Dam with a question. Dennis, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have heard of anything affecting whitetail deer called blue tongue, what it is, what can be done about it, if anything, and how it affects the deer.
Yeah. It's been something that's been involved in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. There's been some problems there in Florida. I think I talked to an entomologist who said he didn't think it was going to be a problem here just because of our climate versus Florida's. But I don't know. Rich, you want to take a crack or comment?
Yeah, I haven't heard a whole lot about the disease here and having it occur in Wisconsin. I would definitely, we have a partner program that we work closely with, the wildlife management program. Those would be the folks that deal a lot with whitetail deer in the state, and those would be the people that you would probably want to check in with that. They also have a wildlife health program in wildlife management, so they're probably most likely keeping their eyes out for that.
I don't think there's, at least at this point, I don't think there's a whole lot of concern about it. You guys certainly would have probably heard about it one way or another, yeah. For sure. And we did. It did come up on the show here a few weeks back, and we talked about it a little bit. And it didn't seem to be, the folks I had on at that point didn't seem to be concerned about it here. Let's hope it stays that way. Well, you know, you do inventory and monitoring. You do provide some information and try and guidance. There's also a regulatory aspect of this as well. Drew, maybe you can.
Yeah, we get involved in regulation. We have some of our own permits that we do for if you want to handle endangered species, for example. And we have a permit related to the state protection for endangered and threatened species. So what we try to do is help provide people the guidance to avoid impacts to those species, or what we call take. That's kind of the official way to say destruction of a state-listed species. And so where we come into regulation is there's a variety of different permits around the state that are used, and typically the a review for potential impacts to rare species is a portion of that
okay.
permit. And so we provide sort of the guidance to help people through that process.
So an example might be what? Let's say somebody wanted to build a property or build a home or a business in an area that may have been have some endangered species of one sort or another, and they need to talk to you.
There's various types of projects. Yeah, building, there's, you know, timber harvests that happen, you know, work on utility lines and so forth. And in a lot of cases, they're doing a screening to see, well, are there any potential rare species that might be impacted by this? And if so, okay, then what? And that's where we help them with the next steps of how would you avoid those impacts or determine whether they're even likely to be present, which in a lot of cases they're not, because you don't have actually the habitat that's needed for that particular species, for example.
I'm thinking about how many acres that we have involved that are connected with this program. It's got to be into the millions, isn't that almost?
Well, the big land ownership portion of our program is through the State Natural Areas Program. We have almost 700. We have over 680 state natural areas in Wisconsin. We don't own all of those. We work with other partners, nonprofit conservation organizations, land trusts, some of the other programs within the DNR, like state parks and wildlife management. They own some of those properties, and we have designated some state natural areas on those Do you know how much acreage we actually
have? No,
it's much less. I'd say it's about 10% of that on SNAs. But then we also work with partners and other programs. So the state ownership, I think, is about 1.5 million acres.
Yeah.
There, we have county partners that we work with, and county forests are actually the largest landowners. But then there's we have some agreements with national forests. So we work with quite a few different land ownerships throughout the state.
Yeah, if you threw the national forests in there, now we're talking about quite a bit of land, for sure. Well, the whole area of regulation and permitting does that take up a large portion of your time, or is it not too bad?
We have about 4 or 5 staff that are largely dedicated to regulation and permitting. And then we have other biologists within our program that are we've designated as species experts, depending on what their level of expertise is for a particular plant or a particular taxa group. So there's some time that is spent also addressing some of these natural heritage inventory rare species hits that Drew was talking about.
Yeah. Drew, you're a tree guy, aren't you?
Yeah, originally my background's forest science. I was a researcher in forests prior to this. And then I've been with the program about 15 years, helping to coordinate the biotic inventories that Rich spoke of, and then eventually becoming what's called our forestry liaison, so working with forestry on issues related to rare species.
Yeah, so managing our state natural areas, obviously forested areas are a big chunk of that.
Yeah, there's forests, there's prairies, there's big wetlands. The natural areas, for people that don't know, I kind of think of them as the best of the best of what we have in Wisconsin. And so in the case of a forest, maybe that's a place where our grandkids will go someday and see an old growth forest, or you'll see a little piece of what maybe used to be on the landscape at one time in the state. And they are a lot of work, though. There's, invasive species. There's a lot of, particularly in things like prairies, you're doing a lot of, brush cutting and burning and things like that to try to maintain those high-quality habitats in the state and that kind of natural heritage for future generations.
Yeah. A couple of more questions coming up. I know we've got some email questions here. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we talk about our natural heritage conservation program and conservation efforts here in Wisconsin with our two guests, Drew Feldenkircher, isn't it?
Yeah, Feldkirchner, but close
Feldkirchner.
Enough.
All right, I got it close enough. Director of the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program, Rich Stafen, conservation biologist with the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nador, on air producer here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation with Drew Feldkirchner and Rich Stafen of the DNR. Great to have them with us today. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, well, let's take a call. Sue in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about the volunteer opportunities to help with these efforts.
Okay. You're in the Madison area?
Well, yes, but I'm also very interested in Bayfield County.
Oh, me too. I've got a cabin up there myself, as a matter of fact. So what about volunteer opportunities? Drew, you want to take that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks, Sue, for asking that. There are a number of volunteer opportunities, and it's a really important way you can help our program, actually. There's work on state natural areas directly, so that's kind of physical work, like controlling brush. In the winter, that can be a fun way to have kind of a party where you're cutting brush and then having a big bonfire and just kind of hanging out with other folks, that are trying to help control the invasives on SNAs. But there's things like collecting seed on SNAs, lots of different works. And when I say SNAs, that's state natural areas, by the way. Also, you can get involved in citizen-based monitoring. So we have citizen scientists throughout the state that are collecting a lot of really important information and have for a long time. And our program does invest in that. We've got a citizen-based science coordinator who kind of helps connect people with the opportunities to do that kind of volunteering.
What would be an example or two of that?
Well, the first one that comes to mind for me is one that I got to participate in several years ago, which was doing a bat survey. That particular survey was a water route. So you got to go out at night. It's kind of an excuse to be in your canoe at night, which is an unusual thing, at least for me. And you have a piece of equipment that can detect bat calls. And so you would just canoe and collect this information, and then at the end of the night you'd hand that equipment off, and you get a nice map the next day or, you know, maybe a month later, depending on the workload at the time, that shows where you went and all the species that, you know, came up during that survey. But there's a lot of other ways to help out, too, and we can tell people where to find that information. We have what's called a citizen-based monitoring network that you can learn more about that. And other opportunities to volunteer are reporting rare species observations. Maybe we'll get into some of the kind of the successes later and new finds, but a lot of times those things come about because citizens are out there with cameras and smartphones or other equipment, and they're just letting us know what's out there. Brand new invasive finds, like the giant hogweed I think you talked about on this program earlier, where, you know, a citizen turned that record in, and so that was hugely important because with a species like that, we want to control it, you know, immediately if we can. So lots of opportunities to volunteer. If you go to the best way is if you go to the DNR website and just put in NHC on the search, you'll get our Natural Heritage Conservation webpage, and it'll show a lot of those volunteer opportunities right on that front page.
So it's NHC? NHC. All right.
Yeah.
Sue, thanks.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. And Sue may not be the only one. I hope we get a lot of clicks on that NHC button at the DNR website. And the DNR, we have a link on our Facebook page, but it's just dnr.wi.gov, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Gil in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Gil.
Hi. My question was inspired by one of the comments by your guest about forest and invasive species. I had a question about prickly ash and buckthorn. Are they invasive species? And if so, how do they threaten the forest? And if they are invasive and do threaten my forest, what control measures might I engage in to combat the prickly ash?
Rich Davin, let's turn to you for that.
Yeah, that's a good question. So those two species, we actually have two buckthorn species. We have common buckthorn and we have glossy buckthorn, which is more commonly found in some of the wetland areas. The common is more the upland buckthorn. Those are both invasives. The prickly ash is actually a native species that can be a little bit weedy in some places. A lot of times if your forest has been grazed, you might see a fair amount of prickly ash coming into some of those forests. We oftentimes, at least in our natural areas, don't do a whole lot of specific management for prickly ash. Maybe some of the prescribed burning kind of keeps that in check. But for the buckthorn, we definitely try and eradicate that as soon as we can find it and as much of it as we can. What we recommend typically is cut stump. So if you cut the buckthorn off near the ground and then treat it with like a glyphosate or Roundup, something like that usually works pretty well.
Directly to the stump.
Directly to the stump.
Right after you cut it.
Yep, exactly. And it's right now is actually a pretty good time to identify buckthorn because it holds its leaves longer and they're still green in a lot of cases at this time of year, where a lot of the other shrubs have dropped their leaves. So you can still pick out the buckthorn in your forest and target it for eradication.
And you have some nice photos, do you not, on information on your DNR website of what those look like and the leaves and everything?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a page dedicated to both aquatic, wetland, and terrestrial invasive species with all the information on how to identify them, how to control them. That's all on our invasives pages.
Yeah, but it's one of those things, you know, with buckthorn as an example, if you see one, get rid of it as quickly as you can because there'll soon be more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your service and hard work.
All right, thanks. Thank you, Gil. Appreciate the call. And let's see, let's turn to Sue in Arlington. Had an email, I want to get her in, asked how the Natural Heritage Conservation Program is funded and how many people are working in the field on state natural areas. Drew, turn to you for that.
Sure, yeah. Well, our funding comes from a variety of sources. The largest piece would be federal grants, actually, if you look at our pie chart. And then we get a much smaller percentage of state funds. But then, of course, as some folks may know, donations are hugely important for our program. And so there's different ways people donate through the tax checkoff. So when you're doing your tax form, yeah. There used to be a loon there. There's no longer a loon, but you still have the opportunity to donate to our program, and we still get a really important source of donations that way. We also receive direct gifts and donations either directly to our program, or we work closely with the Natural Resources Foundation. We have a really good partnership with them, and maybe we'll talk later, or you've probably talked on other shows about the field trips. We're very involved with those and some of the other things. But then also another funding source that we're pretty excited about is our license plates. So people are probably familiar with the Wolf license plate, the Badger, which is now limited edition, so you can't get that new anymore, but there's still quite a few out on the roads. And then our newest plate, which is about a year old, is our Bald Eagle license plate. And so when you buy that license plate, you put that in your car, it comes with a $25 annual donation to our program. And so those really add up, those donations, and they're really important part of getting our work done across the state.
Yeah, absolutely. Lila, I should say, in Marquette County emailed to say there's been a lot of clear-cutting by the DNR in her area. She wants to know what the strategy is behind clear-cutting or some of the other kinds of cutting. And, Drew, you were the tree guy. And there is some, I mean, we just don't go in and clear-cut every area. There's right. some thought that goes into this, obviously. So.
Yeah, so clear-cutting, it's really going to depend on what the goals and objectives are for that particular piece of property. So if you're talking about, I assume we're talking about DNR property, there's kind of a whole host of different types of DNR properties, whether they're wildlife management areas. Of course, we don't have state forests in Marquette County, but there are natural areas. And with natural areas, sometimes we do some things that are pretty dramatic looking. So if we're trying to, for example, restore an oak savanna was a community type that was dominant in the southern Wisconsin prior to Euro-American settlement. And so we have areas where we do try to manage for that oak savanna to keep portions of that on the landscape in these SNAs. But it requires, some pretty heavy cuts in some cases if it's, we're trying to restore it. And so at first, it kind of has to get worse before it gets better in terms of aesthetics and how it looks. But what happens is you do that harvest and you start seeing some of the species that were missing before. Hopefully, we still have the seeds in the seed bank for some of the plants. Maybe the red-headed woodpeckers, for example, might show up. They need that more open habitat. And there's this subset of species that really requires on more open habitats, just like there's other species that use closed canopy forests. So there's kind of a whole range.
Yeah, and grouse hunters kind of like clear cutting, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. In the northern forests and areas where there's good grouse populations, they definitely depend on some of those clearings where there's regenerating aspen. Those are good grouse hunting spots for sure.
Yeah, for sure. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And let's turn to Connie in Partyville next. Connie, thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm concerned about the DNR sort of promotion of trapping a little bit more, even in the parks, the state parks, because of especially the leg traps are non-discriminatory, so they can trap, any of these animals that we really don't want. We don't want. Just a second, okay? Pat is me.
All right. Well, I think we actually have the gist of Connie's comments here. So she's concerned about trapping even on those kinds of properties, and you may be catching or capturing other animals that you really weren't trying to capture. Rich, do you want to take that?
Yeah. There's definitely measures that trappers take to avoid incidental capture through their trapping, and they can, depending on what they're targeting, they can set specific types of traps that would only catch their target critters. There is some concern with overlap in size, probably with dogs, domestic dogs, that is. But with, like in the state parks, there's efforts to move the traps or do the trapping in areas where there's low
foot traffic.
Low foot traffic, yeah, and less people. So move them away from trails, move them away from popular meeting areas, stuff like that. So there is some concern. I think any trapper would probably tell you that, and I don't know that they were all that in favor of trapping in parks, but it is what it is, and they take every precaution that they can to only trap their target species.
Let's take another. Thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Matt to say larger tracts of land are beneficial to many wildlife. Are there plans to consolidate smaller plots into larger plots?
Yeah, that's certainly some of the thinking that goes into kind of when you're thinking about conservation design, and if you're going to try to do, for example, Rich talked about master planning. So if you're working on a master plan for a state forest or something like that, and you might have a particularly sensitive area or high-quality ecological area, and you're going to think about the context that it's within and try to have a favorable context, that's definitely part of our thought process when you go into things like master planning is when they set the project boundaries. So there's an ownership boundary, and there's a project boundary of an area that you might think if there were, say, willing sellers and you had funds to do that, to try to make those bigger pieces. But I guess the answer is ecologically, yes, bigger tracts tend to be more valuable, and it's certainly desirable. Actually making that happen on the ground, it can be pretty challenging in terms of how you get the funds to do that and just having the property available for that.
There's certainly some species that we are aware of that we call area-sensitive species, and those are the ones that do require larger tracts of land. So in cases like that, we're always looking for opportunities to connect smaller parcels and these corridors, like Drew mentioned, to be able to connect up to different properties or an important migratory corridor or movement corridor for wildlife.
Yeah.
So it's a really good comment and something that we try to abide by.
Yeah. And as I think about it, the largest tracts are national forests. I would, you know, to have large masses of land, wouldn't it be, Drew?
Yeah, when you think of large, kind of our largest patches, so ecologists often talk about patches, patch size, and maybe our biggest patch of forest would be Menominee County. If anyone's looked at a satellite photo, you'll see that the whole county lights up as one huge patch of forest. But yeah, certainly the national forests, very large patches. Our state forests are pretty significant. For example, Northern Highland American Legion State Forest is well over 200,000 acres, so that's a good size patch.
But southern Wisconsin, we have some corridors like the Lower Wisconsin Riverway as an important one, and the Baraboo Hills is a really good one, too, where you have some large tracts of land.
Those
and forest.
Are big tracts of land, yeah, absolutely. Well, we had another question here. Let me see. Oh, yeah, Mark emailed to ask if there's a plan to eradicate Phragmites or giant cane grass from cattail swamps and so forth.
I know some of our state natural areas folks and other cooperators in maybe in Door County and some of those areas and the Green Bay portion of the state have undertaken several different measures to try and eradicate and control Phragmites. I don't know if we'll ever completely eradicate it, but they're experimenting with stuff from even like helicopter treatments with herbicide to we used to go out into the wetlands and bundle Phragmites and chop it off and then treat the stems with herbicide to try and remove it from a wetland area. There's lots of work like that that's taken place, and Phragmites is definitely a concern for a lot of our wetland communities throughout the state, not just in the Green Bay area, but that is one of the places where you see it really dramatically is that Green Bay area where it's really become pretty prevalent.
Yeah, it's too bad. I do have a friend who has some property, and they have, as just they when they whenever they go up there, they're treating their area, and it's amazing that area is clear of it, and all around it there's Phragmites, but they keep at their at least their own property and try to do their best they can, and it'd be cool if we could have maybe more of that, although a lot of that. I mean, it's tough work.
Yeah.
Very tough, very resource intensive, as you hear Rich talk about bundling up individual, you know, clumps of plants and treating them. When you think about like Lower Green Bay or some of these places, that the size of that job, you know, it's a real challenge.
Yeah, it's covering that area. It's covering, I was going to say hundreds of acres, but yeah, maybe into the thousands of acres is... As I think about it, so really a tough problem.
Yeah, it really requires cooperation, and there are these weed cooperatives now that have formed to try and consolidate efforts. And
what are those about? So they're a group of...
Yeah, I think it's like certain portions of the state have these weed cooperatives where they can just kind of consolidate efforts and resources to try and work at a bigger scale. And make sure that the work that needs to be getting done is done a little bit more efficiently.
What are some of the, talk a little bit more about some of the things that you're working on right now.
Sure.
Drew, you want to take that first?
Yeah, I'd love to kind of brag about the stuff our staff is doing. You just have to pick which one we want to talk about first. You know, it's pretty surprising, I think, at least for me, in 2016, that we're still finding some new species in the state.
Yeah.
And so we've got, if you look at our website, you'll see our annual report from last year. We're working on our new one, and it's going to highlight a lot of these things. And one of the things is some new species. So we have our evening bat, and I know a number of our staff have been on your show, Larry, and others on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I think we've had some of our staff talk about evening bats, but that was a new species to the state for us that we just found in the southern part of the state this past summer. That's really neat. The nice thing about the evening bat is it's actually not susceptible to white nose syndrome because it doesn't use caves as its overwintering strategy. It leaves Wisconsin for warmer climates. But eastern pod mussel is a new mussel that was recently found in the state. It's actually not considered native, but it's also not invasive. It probably came in on the gills of its host fish. And there's also a damselfly that was found this year called the blue ring dancer. So pretty neat in 2016 to think that we're still getting some new species. Maybe some of these are migrations. You know, we're kind of at the edge of their range, and they're just kind of moving into our state. But it's still pretty exciting.
You know, you think about something like the evening bat, and, you know, as we lose, you wonder if those populations may significantly increase. You know, 20 years from now, we might see a lot of evening bats, and unfortunately, not so many little browns or bats or some of the others, Rich.
Yeah. They can fill different niches in some cases, but... it is possible that, yeah, we would see some of these other species kind of filling some of the niches of some of the ones that we are losing. So we are seeing kind of an interesting pattern where some of the species, like Drew mentioned, the evening bat, which is found further south, and they're kind of close to the border with Illinois, and we're finding other bird species now, too, that... we're kind of right on the cusp of being in Wisconsin, and they're also showing up now through some of our breeding bird atlas efforts that are going on right now. Some species that are moving further north and showing up for the first time in Wisconsin. Like, we had a really exciting find this year of a Mississippi kite for the first time ever nesting in Wisconsin. In Rock County. It's a species usually found further south in swamps, but they had been found in a colony near Rockford, Illinois. So we kind of thought that it would maybe just be a matter of time that they would show up in Wisconsin, and lo and behold, one of our Atlas volunteers found one in Rock County, a nesting pair that had one young this year. So that was one of the most exciting finds thus far of the Breeding Bird Atlas, but they've been doing a lot of great work, and and having a lot of really interesting things turn up.
That program's a great program. That bird itself, is there, what's that, do you know what that bird is like, or what's its habit, you know, what it does and what it...
Yeah, so it's usually found in, like I said, in southern swamps, but it's also kind of taken a liking to some. In Wisconsin, it's nesting in a patch of, like, spruce trees, I believe.
Huh.
So it kind of finds some similar habitat. It's a beetle and cicada feeder, so it was definitely, we have pictures of it feeding a cicada to one of the young nestling birds this year, which is pretty cool. So it's kind of a colonial species too, so the hope is that now that there's been one successful nesting pair, that maybe they'll continue to return, and hopefully the little population there will increase, and we can get some more Mississippi kites in that location and throughout.
Sounds like a good plan to me. Sue in Wausau, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My son is a Cub Scout, and his troop leader asked the boys if there is any particular animal, plant, or insect that is native only to Wisconsin. The boys had no ideas. They were saying, like, the badger and the deer and what have you, and we all know that those are all over the place. But is there an animal, plant, or insect that is native only to Wisconsin?
Native. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Drew?
Yeah, I'll take a crack at it, and maybe Rich can chime in here, too. But there are a couple plants. There's one for sure, and it gets kind of dicey because you have to think about, are we talking about a species or a subspecies? But we consider Facets loco weed a plant that only occurs in Wisconsin. It's actually named after, I believe, Norman Facet, who is one of the most famous ecologists to come from Wisconsin or to spend time here.
Okay.
That's one. There's another one called Cliff Cudweed, and maybe a botanist will correct me here, but I believe Cliff Cudweed is another one that's also only found in Wisconsin. For animals, we don't have as much in the way of what we call endemics like that. But Carter Blue Butterfly almost fits the bill. It is found in other states, but we're really the stronghold. You know, we have a lot of Carters relative to anywhere else, and it's that's why we kind of have a big responsibility for that population.
Yeah. Okay.
We might have, I'm not a snail expert, but I'm thinking that maybe we have a few snail endemics. A lot of our snails, our rare snails, are found along the Niagara Escarpment, which runs from Wisconsin all the way to New York. And I think we have a couple snail that are only found in Wisconsin.
That have only been found in Wisconsin, at least.
It could be, too. not widely studied.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Sue, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, as we talk about the Natural Heritage Conservation Bureau for the Department of Natural Resources with Drew Feldkirchner and Rich Stafen of the DNR. Great to have them along, and I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have or experiences have you had, maybe volunteering or with endangered species in your area or other conservation issues? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at the natural resources of our state with Drew Feldkirchner and Rich Stafen. Drew directs the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Rich is a conservation biologist with the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Jim in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Say, I'm not quite on the topic you are, but I did hear you before talking about trapping animals.
Yeah.
I live in the city of Madison.
Yeah.
And I trap rabbits and squirrels and chipmunks throughout the year, and then I release them a mile or two sometimes away from home. Has anybody have any experience with or know anything? Do they actually make it back again?
Rich, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I think we have heard of folks that have taken them like up to a mile or two away and having some evidence that they do return, even from that distance. So I think there's some estimates that say you need to take a critter like that probably as far as 10 miles away to ensure that it's not going to come back. And, yeah, I guess it's hard to say how safely, if they do try and come that far back, if they're going to end up making it or not, even if it's a short distance, if there's roads to cross and stuff like that. But I think a safe bet would be 10 miles away if you can get that far.
There is a sort of an ethical issue associated with it as well. If you take an animal and put it in an area where it's not accustomed to being, oftentimes those animals don't do well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We think of reptiles and amphibians, too. If you move them, it can be some issues with competition for moving them, depending on what time of the year it is. If you move some amphibians, if it's nearing winter time, they're trying to find a place to overwinter. If you move them away from where they're accustomed to overwintering, it can become an issue for them to find somewhere to safely make it through the winter time. So there's definitely some concerns and some ethical decisions that need to be considered.
And one other issue is squirrels in Madison. If you took all the squirrels off your property and managed to get them all in one day, the next day you'd probably have a whole new batch, wouldn't you, Drew?
I would think so. I mean, that's definitely, this issue along with the foothold traps is something I would defer to our colleagues in wildlife management on. But that'd be my experience. I think they would just immediately fill in that void.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Anyway, a mile may not be far enough. Alan in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Sure, what's on your mind?
You know, I was thinking of the climate up here, and I was out on by the Mississippi up on the bluffs one day, and I seen a lizard.
Yeah.
Out and about, and I didn't even realize or think we had lizards in this kind of climate. So that's what I was trying to call and find out, like, what that would be, what kind of lizard that was. And it wasn't a salamander. It was definitely a lizard. So
okay.
That was my question.
All right.
Yeah, we definitely have a handful of lizard species in Wisconsin. One of the ones that we work a lot with is a state-endangered slender glass lizard that's primarily found in some of the sandier savanna-type areas in central Wisconsin. Where you're at, over in the Mississippi bluffs and along the lower Wisconsin, there's a lot of sand associated with those rivers and the bluff systems. Along the Mississippi, if that's where you saw it on the bluffs, it's most likely a prairie race runner. And we also have a species in northern Wisconsin called the prairie skink. And then we have a five-line skink as well, which is a little bit more of a dry forest species found in a good portion of the state, including like dry conifer forests and openings associated with those type areas. But most likely over on the bluffs in the prairie areas, they hang out under rocks a lot, is the prairie race runner.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Let's turn to Francis in Muskego next. Hi, Francis. Thanks for calling.
I want to know about those thistles that I see all along the road. I'm brought up on a farm, and many years ago as a farmer, we had to make sure those were cut or we would get fined. I don't know if you call those the Canadian thistle or not, but they're really rampant. And
Canada thistle. And Canada thistle, thank you for calling, Francis. That is one of the most difficult weeds, the thistles, to get rid of. They're a tough nut, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty prolific. And yeah, Canada thistle is one that we do try and control where possible. There's also a swamp thistle that I think we're trying to eradicate in some of our northern swamp areas. But yeah, they can be challenging. Mowing is probably one of the best strategies with proper timing, of course. That's always the big issue with mowing, is to mow it before it goes to seed, because if you are mowing it after it's gone to seed, then you're likely just spreading the seed even more so than what you had hoped to do.
And if you have them on your own property, I mean, if you cut them down before those seed heads get going and just keep cutting them down.
Yeah, that's typically what we do with a lot of invasives with well-timed mowing. If you can keep after it it depends on the species but and their strategy, but if you can do it for 4, 5, 6 years, if you keep after it for that long, you will see some improvements in those populations, most likely.
We have other callers and we have some emails as well. Let's take another email. Mike in Algoma emailed to say Russian olive trees are spreading along roadsides on the Anapi Trail in Door County. Are there plans to address the Russian olive trees? Drew, do you have anything on that?
Sure. So we're not familiar with that particular site and what's going on there in terms of this invasive Russian olive. But we can certainly pass that along to our colleagues in parks, and also with Kelly Kearns has been on this program a number of times.
Yeah.
She's our kind of handles invasives within our program and works closely with a lot of folks across the state and has really good connections and would know kind of what to do about that. So we can pass that information on.
Okay, good. Mary Ann in Hurdle called to ask about hunters and compensation for wolves killing their hunting dogs. Is wondering why we do that, or are there plans to change that practice? So anything you know about that, Drew?
Yeah, so wolves are clearly it's a topic where there's really strong feelings on all different sides of the issue, and really a lot of controversy surrounding wolves. In terms of the compensation, that's actually something that's in law, so the only thing that would change that is, a law change. It's not sort of a DNR mandate or a policy or anything like that. So I guess that's where we are with that. And as long as they're on the federal list, so they've been put back on the federal endangered and threatened species list. And so because of that, essentially DNR is on the hook for compensation in those cases.
You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Pat in River Falls next. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Well, I was wondering, with the road people that are doing road work and finishing up highway construction and restorative work, they seem to be planting Mexican knotweed, and it's basically really close to my property as it's going around, and some did end up on my property a few years ago. They just finished doing another little section nearby, and again, here it comes. And I'm wondering if there's some way to inform the county about what they're bringing in, or what can be done about looking into this.
Yeah. All right, let's, who wants to, Rich, you want to try that?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's definitely a major issue and a concern, and I think we would need to touch base with our invasives coordinators, like Drew mentioned, and try and get the word out to them. I know they're working pretty effectively and doing a lot of hard work trying to work with the counties and DOT and trying to control or work with what they plant in those areas. But it sounds like there needs to be some follow-up for sure in this instance as to what they're planting. I would say, yeah, if you can coordinate or contact one of our invasive species coordinators for your region, and there's information on our website for who some of those invasive species folks are, and definitely make them aware and see if we can get a conversation started on how to
quit
prevent
that
from happening. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Just go to the DNR website, right?
Yep. Yeah, we have an invasives page on there.
We have Rodney in Racine called to ask what the science is behind controlled burns and what specific plants are found in an oak savanna.
That's a good question. Yeah. So there's a lot of factors that go into controlled burning to make sure that the conditions are appropriate and proper to do a safe burn. That includes like the relative humidity, the wind speeds and wind directions. So that's all taken into account as to where, kind of like where the burn should be started, how, what kind of measures should be taken to circle the enclose the area where you're trying to burn, and then just do it in a very safe manner to not harm any of the undesirable or any of your desirable trees that you want to keep, or and do it so that you're promoting native species and setting back some of the succession. So that's one of the main reasons we do a lot of burning, is to knock back some of the brush that's crowding some of these areas, closing canopies, like in Savannah that you're talking about here, so that that sunlight can reach the ground layer, so that some of those plants that evolved with those conditions can thrive.
So that's always interesting to me, to see a burned area and then to kind of follow it. If I'm in an area and watch what happens with the growth of new species and stuff, or species that have been there all along but haven't been around in a while, come back.
Yeah, it doesn't take long for it to start to green up. And, I mean, people have shown that if you haven't burned an area for a long time and you start to do some burning, species and seeds that have been dormant for a very long time actually start to show up again.
We are going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Taking a look at the natural resources and conservation efforts going on here in Wisconsin today, and some of the challenges ahead, but also some of the success stories as well. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network as we talk with Drew Feldkirchner, director of the program. Of the Natural Heritage Conservation Program with the DNR, Rich Stafen, conservation biologist. You may have some questions about endangered resources or conservation efforts, and I hope you'll give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post your comments and questions on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And I want to go back to Rodney and Racine. He asked a couple of questions, and one of the questions we didn't get to had to do with the specific types of plants that are found in an oak savanna. Drew, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Sure. I just wanted to point out that, you know, the idea of using prescribed burns is kind of an evolving science that we're continuing to learn from. There's a lot in the literature on it. There's a lot of work we do with partners in the state and our counterparts in other states to try to better understand burns. There's things that we do to try to, for example, have refugia, so places where, because we need the burns to have the habitat for this set of species, but we want to not harm them in the process if we can at all avoid it. So we have things called refugia. And then the other thing was, yeah, just in terms of the plants that occur in oak savannas, there is a list, and I think you can get it on the Wisconsin Herbarium website. And it has what they call indicator plants for these savanna communities. And that can be really helpful for learning about what species might use those habitats.
Very cool. Let's go to Mark in Green Bay next. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm wondering what triggers a biotic survey or an assessment. 5 or 6 years ago, when they started in on the war on Phragmites on the southern end of Green Bay over here, they sprayed 108 miles of shoreline and over 4,800 acres. And I was asking for a biotic survey to see what was there so that you knew what you had damaged at the end of the spray period. And they didn't do it. They did an environmental assessment and came up with a FONSI, which is a finding of no significant impact. But how could that be done without knowing what was there? So I was wondering if you could speak to this issue.
Yeah. All right. Rich, you want to take a crack?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, our involvement with biotic surveys is triggered by master planning, which we mentioned, for state properties on an effort like what you're talking about for the eradication or control of Phragmites in southern Green Bay. It definitely seems like there would be some value to know. We talk about that all the time. That's the significance and importance of doing inventory, is to know what's on your property so that management can be adapt to what species are there I guess I don't know enough about the regulations in terms of what was required of doing an inventory there before spraying. They do do an assessment of what herbicides would be used and what impacts those would have to any potential species that could inhabit those areas. But beyond that, I guess there would be some questions that I don't know mm-hmm. in terms of what the process mm-hmm. involves.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Gary and Fred Isaac, your turn next. Hi, thank you for calling. Gary, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Gary in Prairie du Sac. Let's go to Gary in Boscobel. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I wanted to address the question that was brought up about the woman who thought that there was thistles growing along the road and how to control them. And I'm wondering if she was talking about teasel, mm-hmm. which is an endangered or an invasive species. And I am particularly concerned about invasive species on roadsides, having done 25 years of roadside inventories looking for native plants, especially prairie plants and endangered native plants. And I've watched this terrible spread of teasels and crown vetch and wild parsnip and a whole list of other invasive species that are literally being spread by county highway and township road crews when they do their mowing and spreading these seeds to virtually every corner and every nook and cranny of our state. And it doesn't seem that the powers to be are interested in training employees on how to manage or control those invasive species, garlic mustard, and just terrible, terrible stuff being spread all over and, you know, being mowed at the time when it's full of seeds, so the seed just keeps getting spread farther and farther and farther, and then invading natural areas adjacent to roadsides. So I don't think there's a solution to that, but no. I am deeply concerned about it.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for calling, Gary. Appreciate it. Drew, do you have a comment?
Well, just that, you know, invasive species spread really rapidly along corridors, and roads really provide a perfect corridor for things to spread, and it is a big problem. It's a big way to spread it. Certainly the teasel, I was thinking that as well. It's a real characteristic-looking plant that you can see, and it spreads really rapidly along roadsides. I know for our part, and this is something, you know, our staff, other staff like Kelly that's been on the program could speak to in much more detail, that she works very closely with a lot of partners working on things like best management practices for when to do your mowing, how to avoid spread. We have best management practices related to trying to avoid spread during timber harvest operations, during other things, you know, that's both on the terrestrial side and the aquatic side. So there's a lot of people throughout the state actually working pretty hard on this issue, but it is a challenge, absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Thanks, Gary, for calling. Mike in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Actually, I've been asking it for a number of years since I worked for the DNR back in 2000, 2001. I couldn't get any sense from them. What about this issue about climate change, and what's the point? What's the point in trying to save species in Wisconsin when the habitat is going to be changing for them as well as the climate? It's like fighting a losing battle.
All right. Well, talk about that battle. Drew, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a huge complicated issue that we're very much keyed into and thinking about, because it can potentially affect all the species for which we're responsible in the state. The way we work on that issue most directly is through what's called the Wisconsin Institute on Climate Change Impacts. I believe that's right. I'm so used to the acronym WICCI, W-I-C-C-I. If you were to Google that, you could find that. And certainly doing a lot of thinking about adaptation. So what species, what communities would be able to adapt to potential change, and what would be less likely to adapt? And I think it's a really complicated issue. I don't think we can say all the species are going to be losers or winners. It's going to depend on the species, the habitat they use. how close they are to the edge of their range currently. There's a lot of factors. It's a really complicated issue.
Is it Wiki, did you say?
Yeah, Wiki. I think it's Wisconsin Institute on Climate Change Impacts.
And they're studying that.
Yeah, it's a multidisciplinary group that's working on it. A lot of university folks, DNR's got involvement in it as well.
So maybe we can get a website or some sort of, Jill's looking it up right now. We'll post that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, Mike, if you want to get a link to that organization and what's going on with them. That's certainly worth a look. Jerry in Prairie du Sac, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I called to see if you could give us some information about what the funding that the DNR gets from the Endangered Resources license plates gets spent on. Has that been a successful program?
Yeah, go ahead, Drew.
Sure. We touched on it a little bit earlier, but that goes to the Endangered Resources Fund. And so that funds a chunk of our work in the Natural Heritage Conservation Program. So it's really a variety of different things that we work on. We've been talking about a number of them today. There's quite a few more. We could spend a lot of time talking about the kind of the breadth of things that we work on. I would say one good thing you could do to just kind of get a feel for all the work that we do is, again, go to the DNR website, put in NHC. You can get our annual report, and you can get a good idea of some of the things that we work on and how we spend those dollars.
How many of those plates do we sell in a year? Do you have any idea?
Well, we're working on it. I think, you know, when the Wolf plate first came out, that was the only kind of unusual plate at the time.
Yeah.
And it was really, really popular, really took off. It's declined. We still have quite a few Wolf plates on the road. I'm going to probably say the wrong number here. I want to say it's like 11,000. That could be way off. It's still our most popular plate. The Eagle plate's only been around a year, but we've sold, you know, quite a few of those plates. You know, it's over 1,000 plates at this point.
And, so there's $25,000.
Yeah, and actually, we're over that. I should have brought the numbers with me. I can maybe get that for the next, if we have time. But, yeah, it's a significant source of funding for us. And the thing that's really great about it is it's a small donation, but it's a regular donation that occurs, you know, year after year. And so it's more sustainable than some of the other sources.
Yeah, and you get used to, you know, just you get the bill and you don't even really think about it. Some people may even forget that they're actually supporting that particular program. I mean, it just comes in the mail and you send the check and there you go. Yeah.
And I did get a reminder from one of my colleagues here to mention that we don't use that license plate money for wolf damage payments, nor do we use any of our gift or donation money for wolf damage payments. We get that question a lot, so I just thought we could throw that out there.
And that comes from out of some other state coffers, I guess.
It comes through other sources. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. All right, and David Augusta called and said, hey, you ought to have a new muskie license plate, a new fish license plate with a muskie on it. I'd probably buy one of those if I... And trust Dave and Augusta to ask that question. Has that ever come up?
I don't know about muskies specifically, but my understanding is there are a number of plates that have been proposed, and we might be seeing some new plates on the road. DOT is really the one that coordinates that. The muskie plate, of course, it wouldn't go to the Endangered Resources Fund.
No, it wouldn't then.
So it would be a competition for our program in terms of funding, but... yeah, I know there's a number of other plates being discussed at this time.
Let's talk about, do we have another question up here? Shane in Cumberland called to ask if there are plans to bring elk in any new areas of Wisconsin. Well, we've got a couple now, haven't we, Rich?
Yeah, we have there's two populations. There's one in the Jackson County Black River State Forest area that they're working on, moving elk from Kentucky up here to... start that population, and they're also boosting the population up near Clam Lake and Price County, that area as well. But I'm not aware of any other future plans to introduce any more elk. But again, that would be something to weigh or check in with your local wildlife biologist and see what those future plans might be.
Yeah, that new program has just really gotten underway quite recently, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think this is probably the second or third year that they've been bringing elk up here for Jackson County.
Yeah, so there's those two programs. You know, you need a you need a kind of a certain type of area to be able to support a population like that. I can talk about that on another show with one of our other wildlife large animal guys from DNR or otherwise. That couple of the sort of the new things that we haven't talked about. For one, I was kind of interested in the Kirtland's warbler, and we're starting to see more Kirtland's warblers.
Yeah, we had a really good year for Kirtland's warblers this year. We have kind of our core population is in central Wisconsin and Adams County, and we've been monitoring that population since they were first discovered there in 2008. And this year we had 20 singing males in Wisconsin. We have a census that we do in the early part of June that gives us our official count numbers. And we have a lot of volunteer help actually goes into helping us with the census. We have volunteers where we identify potential habitat areas where we want folks to go out and look and listen for Kirtland's warblers. So we had a good year in Adams County that the number of 20 singing males was up, has been increasing since pretty steadily since for the last couple of years as one of our highest figures for that core population. But also, excitingly, we had some new populations in the northern tier of the state. We had three nests in Marinette County this year that produced 10 young.
Wow.
And we also had a nest in Bayfield County that produced 5 young. So we had 15 fledglings in the northern part of the state, which is the most we've ever had in northern Wisconsin. So they've been doing some experimental playback survey or playback work in those areas where they put out a collar that attracts the birds. And it seems like it's been pretty successful to attract birds to those areas. Attracted 4 males and 1 female, which they did nest then in Bayfield, like I said, and even more in Marinette County, where we're seeing good numbers there as well. So it's been a good year for good news for Kirtland's warblers, for sure.
And the Karner, we did mention Karner blues, but we're seeing a nice uptick in Karner blues, are we not? Butterflies?
Yeah, that's true, too. We had really good numbers for Karner blues. A lot of it, I think, can be pointed towards some increased management and really effective management that's taken place in some of our barrens areas where lupin is present, the host plant for Karner blues. And I think we had well over 100,000, 107,000, almost 108,000 Karner blues were counted, which is a record high number this year in Wisconsin. So great news on that front.
Yeah, Ed, for sure. And piping plovers now in Green Bay area?
Yeah, there's been a restoration project on Cat Island, which has really attracted a lot of shorebirds and a lot of terns. A lot of those species are all either state or federally threatened species, and we had our first nesting piping plovers back in the Green Bay area this year in 75 years. So, pretty exciting news from that perspective, and a great project with the restoration there of Cat Island.
And what about the Brule River? I know there's some work going on in the Brule River State Forest.
Yeah, so that's we've been talking a little bit about biotic inventory efforts, and it kind of all started with state forests, and one of our first master plans was on the Brule River State Forest. So it's been 15 years, I think, so it was time to go back and redo that whole process. So we were doing some surveys in Brule River the last couple of years. We found some pretty interesting plants. There's in some of our cedar swamps in the Brule, those are kind of one of the signature community types in the Brule River way up north there. And there's lots of orchids, rare orchids that they found in some of these cedar swamps. And they also found a state endangered plant. It's only the second population of the Lapland buttercup.
Mm-hmm.
So Both of them are from that general area. It's kind of a small plant, but they did find a population of those in the Brule River as well. So, like I said, I think it's only the second population in the state for that species. We're also doing some wood turtle work up in that area, doing a kind of a mark recapture population estimate and marking a lot of turtles, wood turtles in that area. So that was really good news for the numbers of wood turtles in the area. They're also doing a lot of effort with nest site creation in Douglas County to help address some of the issues with the reproduction for wood turtles. So that's been a pretty successful project as well, helping the wood turtle numbers.
As you guys think ahead, just thinking ahead a little bit, what kinds of challenges do you see on the horizon for us here in the state? Drew, you want to take a crack?
Sure. I mean, I think we talked about some of them already. Invasive species continue to be a big challenge for a number of reasons. Climate change could potentially be a really big impact, a really big challenge for us. There's always a challenge in terms of you only have so much resources to try to do this good work, and so we're constantly trying to think of how can we be most efficient and most effective throughout the state. And part of that's really, like I said, working with partners, working with volunteers. We didn't get into it today, but we're working more and more with private landowners. And so if there's private landowners that are interested in working with us and, you know, learning more about your property and the opportunities to conserve our species, we have opportunities on our webpage. You can learn about those things.
And can people actually come out and look at a property?
In some cases, you can. We have a kind of a pilot project we've started. We call it the Landowner Lottery. And so the idea here is we can find people that really want to work with us on this. And we give out 100 of these, what we call landowner conservation reports. And in some cases, we can come out to your property, talk about it. That's only 100. And we had, I think, 1,100 folks that were interested. So it's limited. It's really in its early stages. But I think it's been really successful in kind of connecting us with people that are looking to do this kind of work on their properties.
And in terms of, we did talk about volunteering and so forth, but I think it'd be good to go back to that. How do you make a donation? How do you volunteer? You know, one thing you can do is buy a license plate, one of those endangered species license plates.
Absolutely. License plate, any kind of, you know, there's direct donations, gifts. There's a lot of ways financial, but again, there's a lot of ways that aren't financial. Those volunteer opportunities, there's, you know, if you want to talk to us about any of these things, you know, we're certainly, I know we've had a lot of staff on your program and other programs here. We try to have a presence at different places. I think we'll be at Canucopia as our plan. That's not till March, but we're typically at the State Fair. We've got people doing kind of presentations at various places, and we've got our website. So I think that's the best place to start. Go to our website. DNR website, put in NHC in the search term, and you'll get a lot of the things that we talked about here today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. NHC, right? Those are the initials?
Yep, Natural Heritage Conservation.
Well, I want to thank you guys both for being with us. I hope we'll have a chance to talk again about some of the efforts going on, and appreciate your time here. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Drew Kirchner, director of the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program, and Rich Stafen, who is a conservation biologist with the DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Fun to talk with them about some of the successes and also some of the challenges. There's plenty of those out there as well. Tomorrow we'll look at new treatments for depression, among other things. Stay with us. Lots in store.